This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. More than 30% of women deliver their babies by C-section in the United States. Back in 1970, that number was 5%, but this hasn't corresponded with a rise in healthy outcomes. While C-sections are sometimes necessary to prevent lifelong disability or death in newborns, they also put new mothers at greater risk for postoperative complications and add billions to the cost of childbirth. But if doctors are performing more of them on patients, there must be a good reason, right? Well, a new study from the National Bureau of Economic Research shows that doctors actually perform fewer C-sections when their patients are also doctors. Aaron Johnson is an MIT economist and co-author of this study.
We found that doctors are about 10% less likely to get C-sections. So obstetricians appear to be treating their physician patients differently than their non-physician patients.
So it seems that C-sections are expensive. They prolong the recovery of mothers. They aren't performed as often on patients with medical expertise. Why then this big increase? One reason is the fear of multi-million dollar lawsuits and the high rates of malpractice insurance that comes along with that. Another is the societal expectation for risk-free birth. Our one guest today calls the rise of the C-section an epidemic in America. We want to hear from you. Have you had a C-section? What was your childbirth experience? You can call us at 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. You can send us an email at wherewelive@wnpr.org, or you can tweet us at wherewelive. You can also join a conversation that's already ongoing at wnpr.org. Joining us today is Professor Teresa Morris, who's professor of sociology at Trinity College and the author of a new book called Cut It Out, The C-Section Epidemic in America. Welcome to our show.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
And Dr. Peter Dolger is here. He's an obstetrics and gynecology specialist with the Connecticut Multi-Specialty Group. Thank you very much for being here as well.
Thank you very much, John. It's a real treat.
Now, I want to start with you, doctor, because I want to explain to our listeners who don't know exactly what it is we're talking about. What is a C-section?
A C-section is a way of delivering a baby that's an operative delivery. Patient's brought into the operating room and some type of incision is made on the abdomen and the uterus, and the baby is removed through that incision.
What would be the typical medical reason to perform a C-section?
There are basically two reasons to perform C-sections. One is that the patient cannot tolerate labor. So there are medical indications that a woman's not able to actually tolerate labor, and you have to bypass that and go to surgery. And the other is for fetal concerns. There's something going on in the labor that makes you concerned about how the baby's tolerating labor, and because of that, you opt to perform the surgical procedure.
When would you typically know this? Would this be something that you would know far in advance, or is this something that you would schedule at the last possible minute?
It runs the entire gamut. You sometimes know this before the patient even conceives. Some patients have some medical conditions that you know that they're always going to have a C-section no matter what. And sometimes you don't know until the last absolute moment and you're running down the hallway trying to explain to the patient why they need a C-section. So it's incredibly variable.
Do you have an idea how many C-sections you've performed?
Oh, numbers?
Yeah.
No.
It's been many?
Many.
Many. A last question before I turn to Teresa for you right now. Do you have women who come to you and say very specifically that they want to have a C-section or that they very much do not want to have a C-section at any cost? Is this a typical conversation, I suppose, you have?
It's a very typical conversation. The patient who wants a C-section is very rare. It's made a big deal in the media, but it's a very rare occurrence. More likely is discussion that explained to me on no certain terms that they do not want a C-section.
Mm. So, Teresa Morris, let's talk about this rate of change over the years. We hinted at these numbers early on that back in, say, the 1970s, maybe only 5% of women got C-sections. And even as recently as 1996, we heard in our introduction to the show, we're talking about maybe 20%. Now it's a full third of women. Talk about this rate of change, what you've seen here, and why you think this is happening.
Right. Well, the explanation that I use to explain C-sections are cost pressures that the healthcare industry has experienced, much due to changes that Congress had on reimbursement rates for Medicare that spread throughout the insurance industry. If someone's interested, I can talk more about that. But the bottom line is that hospitals and maternity providers, in this case I focus on maternity providers, were no longer guaranteed reimbursement for the costs they incurred treating a patient. They were rather reimbursed for a particular diagnosis. That put pressures on the industry, which led to corporatization and a growth of hospital systems, as well as a growth of practices. We may have 20 years ago, 30 years ago, seen obstetrical practices, and Dr. Dolger could probably talk about this, with one or two physicians, obstetricians, and now that's very unusual, and most obstetricians practice in practices that have six or more physicians. And that puts different pressures because you have to standardize care across those different patients and make decisions. But the bigger reason that I see is that that physicians and hospitals aren't able to necessarily control those costs in a way because it's due to some changes in congressional decisions. But what they can try to control are liability concerns. And the liability environment has really changed in past years. We know that physicians now pay in Connecticut on average about $150,000 a year for malpractice insurance. And that's to insure themselves in case they make a medical error that the patient will be reimbursed for that error.
Well, and we'll talk a little bit more about the high cost of right. malpractice insurance in just a little bit.
Sure.
Let's get back to this idea of congressional action
as we were talking
about. Mm-hmm. So are we seeing here over the scope of time a very gentle increase, or was there a large scale increase at a certain period that's linked to some sort of legal change?
Right. Well, the increase really started in the 1980s when we saw those pressures on Congress. So from all through the 1980s, the rate increased to about 25%. And then we saw a drop in the rate somewhat because vaginal birth after cesarean section was being encouraged for women. And we know that half of all C-sections that are performed are repeat C-sections. So when vaginal birth after cesarean section, so a woman has a C-section and then is able to have a vaginal birth, we know the rates will drop. And that happened through the 90s. So that was a decision somewhat tied to the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists encouraging. When that went away, we know that C-section rates started going up in 2000 and have continued to increase since then. And a lot of that is a decision the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists had on not encouraging vaginal births. So I think the congressional changes happened in the 1980s, and those haven't changed. I think after that, I think that set in motion an increase in the C-section rate. And after that, I think then there were practice decisions and decisions by what's called ACOG, American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists.
Well, it seems as though this idea that something went away after a certain period of time, that this idea, doctor, of a vaginal birth after C-section was something that was in vogue for a while, and then it became out of vogue. Why exactly?
So when I started my training, the theory was once a C-section, always a C-section. And then some data coming out and starting to encourage us, maybe we could actually try that patient was previously had a C-section to bring them in and have them have a vaginal delivery.
And again, the reason for this early training would be what? Some sort of increased risk to the mother, something about the C-section that happens that does not allow theoretically someone to then have a traditional birth?
Yes, thank you. So the concern is that when you have a C-section, you have a surgical scar on your uterus, okay? And then later on in life, you're going to ask that uterus to go into labor, and they're going to exert a lot of force on that scar. And the concern is that scar strong enough and will it hold together? Okay, and if it doesn't hold together, there can be some very, very serious complications to the mother and the baby. So that's our concern. And initially, the fear was that that was too much of a concern. Everyone has to just keep having C-sections. And then the data looked at it and encouraged the right patient to try to have a vaginal attempt of vaginal delivery afterwards. And it was interesting. It was a very big thing in our field. It was things that we would be proud of. We were so excited when we got our section rate down below 20%. And it was, you know, it was a lot of pressure to really encourage patients to have a trial labor afterwards. And so that was what was going on for a while. And then it's just fascinating. People, words are so important. I know you talk about this in the book, but ACOG came out. ACOG is our college. It's our group, and they give us advice. And these statements they come out with every now and then, they changed one word in the statement. Because of the concern of the uterus rupturing, they said that the physician and the anesthesiologist had to be immediately available while you're trying to have a vaginal delivery after a C-section. So that meant that the obstetrician had to be in the hospital and the anesthesiologist had to be in the hospital and probably the pediatrician had to be in the hospital. For big city hospitals, not a big concern, but where most of the healthcare takes place in this country, they don't have anesthesiologists for 24 hours a day. So that one word change made people very nervous and less willing to encourage women to try to have a vaginal delivery.
Was that one word change made because of some clear data that said this is going to cause a problem, that women, Teresa, are going to die if indeed this isn't done this way?
No, I don't think it was due to any change in data. I think that the risk has been a known risk of about a half a percent of a uterine rupture. Now, most babies do fine even if there is a uterine rupture. Catastrophic uterine ruptures are very, very rare, and very few babies die in a VBAC attempt due to a uterine rupture. The estimate is between 2 and 4.7 per 10,000 VBAC attempts.
And again, when you're saying VBAC, again, this is vaginal birth after cesarean that we're talking about throughout.
So I don't think it was due at all to data. I think it was due to a recognition that if there was a uterine rupture and a baby had a very bad outcome, that the physician would be held would be sued for that. And I'll just add one other thing, that there are, it's very clear in the ACOG practice recommendations on this. The most recent practice bulletin on vaginal birth after cesarean came out in 2010, and it's very clear in that practice bulletin and in the literature that supports it, that the reason ACOG still wants physicians and anesthesiologists immediately there is they feel that the physician will be protected if there is a bad outcome if he or she is in the hospital. It doesn't mean the outcome is less bad outcome is less likely to happen, but rather it's having the physician there makes less likely that there will be a liability or a physician will be accused of malpractice.
You want to jump in, doctor?
It's just so interesting, this whole case, because the data didn't change, but all of a sudden people are starting to publish articles saying that the rate is, and it's always, the numbers have all been the same, less than 1%. And a point I make to my patients all the time, there are wound separations. And most wounds will separate and you'll never even know about it. So we're talking about incredibly rare events. The data stay the same. All of a sudden, articles coming out saying this is too risky. Editorials from very well-known physicians say, would you get on an airplane if you know there's a 1% chance it's going to crash? And then you can just feel the oxygen go out of the room, and all of a sudden we're not as aggressively, you know, coaching our patients to think about vaginal delivery after C-section.
We're talking about C-sections in America. It's the subject of a new book by Teresa Morris called Cut It Out, The C-Section Epidemic in America. And we're taking your calls at 860-275-7266. Cynthia is calling from Storrs. Hello, Cynthia. Go ahead.
Yeah, there's one thing that I see that you have not addressed yet, and that is when a woman who's in labor goes into the hospital, her labor is now managed by that hospital, which means to me that they give you drugs to induce you. They give you drugs to just to stop the pain of the baby's birth. But mostly when they induce you, I think that it introduces something that you cannot control or manage by yourself. And then when you don't progress, they decide to, it's the best thing to cut you. And I don't believe this at all. I think that they should leave laboring women alone unless there is a problem.
Cynthia, thank you very much. It's one of the things we do want to address. Teresa, you want to pick up on what Cynthia has to say?
Sure. Cynthia, I absolutely agree with you about the management of labor. We know that 41% of women have their labors induced in the United States, and we also know that women who have their labors induced, and that would mean that the labor doesn't start spontaneously. Rather, a drug is used to induce uterine contractions. We know that women who have induced labors are twice as likely to have a C-section as women whose labors aren't induced. And this is particularly the case for women who have not labored before and who have a uterus who maybe isn't I'm now personifying a uterus. A uterus that is what's called closed and thick. It hasn't started to dilate at all. Those women have a 50% chance of a C-section. So inductions really do raise the risk. And I think in management, the thing that bothers me the most is the continuous use of an electronic fetal monitor. We know that on low-risk women, monitoring the baby's heart rate continuously rather than intermittently, for example, every 30 minutes during active labor, increases their risk of C-section by quite a bit. Recent estimates show that low-risk women, so those are women without underlying medical conditions, women who have one baby that's head down, they, for every six women who are monitored continuously, we know one will have a C-section. So we know that A woman wearing a continuous fetal monitor increases her chance of C-section, but we also know it does not improve fetal outcomes. So I think in terms of labor management, that's one thing that really I feel like we need to address is that continuous use of the monitor.
Well, and this idea of outcomes, too, we're going to get to another phone call in just a moment, but over the course of time, one might think that as we've increased the number of C-sections, that there would be medical reasons for this, and that indeed it would mean better outcomes for women and for the children. Has this actually been the case? Have we seen worse outcomes in some cases?
Right. No, there haven't been better outcomes. In fact, we know one thing that public health people working in public health are very concerned with is the maternal mortality rate. That's the death of a woman within 40 days after a birth is going up. And in the past 20 years, it's increased 75%. Recent estimates are that C-sections play a role in that. It doesn't totally explain it. Maybe about a quarter of those deaths are due to C-sections.
But let's just get to real numbers. I just want to make sure. As we're talking about 75% increase, at what percent level? I mean, what is the likelihood that someone would die during a C-section in America? I just don't want to scare people.
Oh, no, I don't want to scare anyone either. No, women aren't likely to die, but they're more likely to die with a C-section than a vaginal birth. Could I defer just a moment to Peter Dolger while I look up that data for you?
Absolutely. And Peter, I'd like to ask you about that, about the outcomes. Specifically, let's talk about the mothers right now. Under C-section, this is indeed just like any surgery. It's an invasive procedure. There are any number of things that can go wrong during a procedure like this. Maybe you can talk about that, about how risky it is for the mother.
Sure. I'd really love to just take a step back just for a second, if I may.
Sure.
In terms of these decisions we're making, and sometimes you look at these decisions and wondering, what are we doing? You know, as a field, what are we doing? And my good day in the office is being at a delivery, talking about a front row seat, and you watch this amazing event happen, and you work with the patient, and it really is labor. It's hard labor a lot of the time, and the baby comes out, and the look on the woman's face and how it changes. And you want to talk about instant love. Love is first sight. And you hand this baby to the mom, and they do skin to skin, maybe start breastfeeding, and then the dad starts crying. You know, if you haven't done that, if you haven't been personally done it or be able to see it, you have no idea. That is my good day in the office, all right? Now I got to tell you about my bad day in the office, okay? First week into my residency, they asked me to go see this patient because they can't find a heartbeat, okay? She's full term. The nurse can't find a heartbeat. I walk in. I put an ultrasound on the woman's belly, and I instantaneously know her baby has died, okay? Mm. First thing, I want to vomit, this incredible wave of nausea. Number two, I want to run out of the room. They never taught me in med school what to do with this, okay? And I have to tell this woman who's so excited about having a baby that her baby's dead. Okay, and then over the next couple hours and days, I have to work with this couple. I have to go through a labor. Okay, and you tell a woman her baby's dead, they make a noise that you can't believe comes out of a human. Okay, and then you deliver a dead baby, and that noise comes out again. Okay, that's the baggage I bring into every room that I go in. Okay, or the 26-year-old woman who's had preeclampsia and seized, and after 2 weeks, we're taking her off the respirator as her husband's holding her and sobbing. Okay. So we're going to talk about a lot of things here, and malpractice has a lot to do with it. But that's my number one concern, is not to have to go through that. Because every time I go through that, a little bit of my soul dies. Mm. And that's nothing compared to what the patient's going through. And that's our motivation in this field.
And given that motivation and given the reality of that, one of the reasons, you know, we want to have this conversation today is we want to try to get at what is the thing that we can do as a society or in medicine, and we bring in Congress and people make laws around this stuff, or people put words in a manual. What can we do as a society to make it so that you have more of the good days and fewer of the bad days? And some of the things are things we can control and some of the things we can't. So given the conversation we're having today, is there something that we're doing right now in your field that's making it harder to have those outcomes that you just described as the good day for doctor, for patient, for everybody?
Sure. I think we're doing too many things to protect ourselves. Okay, there's a bad event at the hospital, a sentinel event, something horrible happens, a bunch of committees get together, and there has to be an action plan. There has to be an action plan before the Department of Health comes in, and rules are changed based on no science at all. So you're stuck with this situation where we're doing things not based on science, really based on to protect the institution, and ourselves. And you can't blame them. You know, getting sued is a horrible thing for the physician. It's a horrible thing for the nurse. It's a horrible thing for the institution. You know, the hospitals are not doing well. You know, their funding's going down. And trying to make changes that are going to make them more at risk for being sued, it's just not going to happen.
We were talking about the rise in the number of C-sections in America. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue our conversation with Dr. Peter Dolger, who's an OBGYN with Connecticut Multi-Specialty Group, and also with Teresa Morris, who's a professor of sociology at Trinity College. Her new book got us started in this conversation. It's called Cut It Out, The C-Section Epidemic in America. We're going to take some of your phone calls. A lot of you want to join us at 860-275-7266. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today we're talking with the author of a new book called Cut It Out, The C-Section Epidemic in America. Teresa Morris is a professor of sociology at Trinity College. We've been talking about this rise in the number of C-sections in American society since the 1970s, and it's risen quite a bit. We're also talking with Dr. Peter Dolger, who's an OBGYN at Connecticut Multi-Specialty Group. We're going to take some of your phone calls in just one moment. I quickly want to ask Teresa to just go back to one thing we were talking about, this rise in the number of C-sections. Has it corresponded with a rise in better health outcomes for the mother and the child?
No, we know that it hasn't corresponded with better health outcomes. I had mentioned maternal mortality rates, and that's the death of a woman within 40 days after a birth going up. And that has gone up 75% in 20 years. So it was 12 per 100,000 live births in 1990. And it was 21 per 100,000 live births in 2010. So women aren't likely to die. But the concern is, in a country like ours, why is it going up? And other countries, which we would usually not compare ourselves to, Lithuania, Croatia, have lower maternal mortality rates. In terms of fetal mortality, and this is neonatal mortality, so that's within the first 28 days of life, for a vaginal birth, the neonatal mortality rate is 0.72 per 1,000 live births. And for a C-section, it's 1.73 per 1,000 live births. So that's about 2.4 times. Babies are 2.4 times more likely to die in a C-section birth than a vaginal birth. But the risk is still slight.
And you can't assume that's all. But you can't assume that's all due to the C-section.
Exactly.
Because you have a sicker mother. You know, the baby, we're taking care of sicker people. Okay, you know, diabetes is going up. People more people are not getting prenatal care. Obesity is a gigantic problem. So it may be true and partially related, but, you know, just because someone's getting a C-section and the more babies dying doesn't necessarily mean it's the C-section is the reason the baby's dying. There may be part of the fact, maybe the medical condition that leads to a C-section, and that also affects the baby.
But not particularly good news that all these other medical conditions are conspiring against mothers and their children over the course of the last 30, 40 years, as it seemingly American health should be getting better.
Right. I would just say that the study that I quoted on fetal mortality is a study that took out into account women's medical conditions and didn't include any women with adverse medical conditions, and actually included in the C-section group only women who planned to have a C-section, and the women who planned to have a vaginal birth, whether they had a C-section or vaginal birth, their babies were included in the vaginal birth data. So it's called an intention to treat study, and it's the best design we could use. So in this case, actually, those numbers do take into account any risk factors that the mom would have.
I want to get to some phone calls quickly before we bring in our next guest, 860-275-7266. Mary is calling from Middletown. Hello, Mary. Go ahead.
Hi. How are you today, Tom?
Doing well. What's on your mind?
Well, I just wanted to say that I'm the proud mother of two kids. One's three. One is going to be two here in the next week. And luckily, I had two C-sections for both of my children. And it was something that my doctor and I discussed thoroughly before we scheduled them. Unfortunately, a couple years back, I was in a horrible car accident and have had many and many of back problems since. And I'm glad that my doctor said, you know, for the back pain, you know, this is something that could be a little bit more beneficial having this cesarean. And I did both. My recovery went very well. I did not need any of the pain medication for them, and I was pretty much up and walking within, you know, 3 or 4 days. So they both went very well, and I'm very thankful to my doctor for giving me that option.
Mary, thank you very much for sharing that story. Doctor?
That's great. I think that's, you know, it's definitely some people benefit from having cesarean. I think one of the reasons it's so important this book was written, first of all, it's getting our attention back on something that I think we may have lost some interest in. But I'm amazed how emotional it is for some women, how much they almost mourn their birth when they end up with a C-section. And I just saw someone yesterday, and she said I could share her story, but I was getting a history. First baby was a C-section, and she had two vaginal deliveries afterwards. But she said to me, I felt cheated or almost incomplete after having a C-section. And I have patients who years later, I'll get a history and ask them about surgery, and they'll start crying about the fact that they've had a C-section. And it's something that you really can't go home and talk to people about, because they're going to look at you and say, what are you upset about? You have a healthy baby. You know, so-and-so can't even have children. So this, I don't think we should underestimate how upsetting and how much damage this can do to a certain group of women.
I want to get one more quick phone call here from Kate in Middlebury before we move on. Hi, Kate. Go ahead. Hi, Kate. Are you there? We're going to put Kate on hold, and perhaps we can get her back. I want to bring in Michelle Mello, who joins us. She's professor of law and public health at Harvard School of Public Health, to join us a little bit to talk about some of the reasons why perhaps this rise has happened over the years. Michelle Mello, welcome to Where We Live. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
What associations are there between the fear of liability for doctors and the C-section rate, in your view?
Well, this has been a contested area for scholars working on understanding the association. Basically, we have a fairly moderate-sized literature at this point that points in two different directions. There are some good studies showing statistically significant associations between the level of liability risk in a state and the C-section rate, and there are also some good studies that don't show that. I think the best studies indicate there is an association.
Mm. When we talk about defensive medicine and the cost of it in America, and specifically surrounding this issue, maybe you can put some numbers on it for us, Michelle. What is the cost of defensive medicine right now?
Well, nationwide, when you look across all clinical areas, not just obstetrics, we estimate it's something on the order of about $54 billion a year. Now, that's just a tiny proportion of our nation's healthcare bill, maybe around 2 to 3%, but it's a big number in absolute terms.
So talk about the rules and protocols that hospitals are using to protect themselves. We started off the program talking a little bit about some of these issues, but I think it's important to really dig into this a little bit. Talk about how hospitals have decided to protect themselves against adverse outcomes in childbirth.
Well, I'm not sure I can speak to that better than Dr. Dolger can. Certainly, this is an issue that is very much on hospital risk managers' radar screens because the bigger problem from a legal perspective is not neonatal mortality, but rather children who survive but are severely neurologically impaired and need a lifetime of care. Those are the most costly claims that are in the medical liability system. So their focus is very much on prevention of those events, and they're instituting a variety of safety protocols to try to improve the childbirth process. Dr. Dolger can speak to that better than I can. But they're also thinking about how to resolve events that do happen in a way that's more productive and less painful for both the involved families and the involved providers.
And perhaps Teresa Morris, before I asked Dr. Dolger about this, a more, I suppose, cynical way that one might look at this is it seems from the numbers that you've shared in your book and that Michelle is sharing with us right now that the health of the mother is less important somehow than the health of the child when it comes to what it might cost a hospital or a doctor in a bad outcome. Is that fair to say, Teresa?
I think it is fair to say, at least from a provider perspective. I did base my book on talking to maternity clinicians or providers. And universally, the obstetricians told me, and not in a cynical way, because I do, you know, I very much respect providers, and I think you can hear the care that Dr. Dolger has for his patients. But I think providers have learned that women are less likely to sue that for bad outcomes for themselves, health outcomes, particularly if it's an injury, and are less likely to be highly compensated for that than a bad baby outcome. And I think they've learned that through the legal system. So I don't think it's a value necessarily that physicians are placing on the lives and health of babies and women. I think they've learned what they have to do. to make it less likely that they will be sued.
Can you talk about these pressures on you and your practice, doctor?
Yes, I think it's interesting. I think if someone held a gun to my head and I'm in a room, I'd probably save the mother before the baby. I think from a very early stage in your training, though, you're told the story that you're in court and they bring in this incredibly injured infant, and you're done. You have no chance of getting a fair hearing. And you're taught in training that you will never, ever be faulted for doing one too many section, but it could be the end of your career by doing one fewer. So, and in attempts to make it safer, we've almost given ourselves more things to worry about and almost many more reasons to decide, I can't tolerate this chance anymore. I need to go to a section now. To protect, really to protect the baby, but also you can't deny the fact that you're always trying to protect yourself also.
Has this affected you personally?
Oh, God, yeah. I had a horrible lawsuit. I'm listed in Teresa's book. I was at one point, I had the highest settlement ever in Connecticut. And, you know, my training was that, you know, you're smart, you study hard, and you really care about your patients, and you spend time, you talk to them, and every day you make the best decision based on your training, and everything's going to be okay. And then you have a horrible outcome, and you think you did the best you did, and then someone in the hospital suggests, you know, you shouldn't come. You come to the hospital, you should go home with a healthy baby. And then a lawyer's business card is handed out, and then all of a sudden you're getting deposed, and you're spending 4 weeks in court, hearing how about you're the worst physician ever, And I feel sorry for the people in the jury. The poor people in the jury, for two or three weeks, you're going to educate them about a field that it's taken me years to figure out. And it's good that Americans are sympathetic. But if they're going to try to decide if you've deviated the standard of care, there's no way in the world a jury can do that after a baby's brought in for a day. After this child was brought in, I went home and I said, yeah, I should lose. I hope I lose. This is so unfair for this family.
But something in the middle of what you said there is there is this expectation in society, it seems, that if you go to the hospital pregnant, you should come home with a healthy baby. Teresa Morris, throughout the history of not America but the world, that's not necessarily always the truth. There is some inherent risk involved. This is something that does not always have a good outcome. Have we gone too far in America in thinking that, yes, you go to the hospital pregnant after doing everything right and you should come home with a healthy baby?
I think so. I think that that is a common expectation. And I think that it also, part of the reason that we believe these things is because women are hooked up to monitors continuously. They are monitored, you know, frequently. And they have testing throughout pregnancy. And I think that that leads into the belief that if you do everything right, if you do what your doctor asks you to, if you wear the monitors, everything will be perfect. And I think that we do not emphasize enough to women and families that sometimes you can do everything right as a patient and the physician and nurses can do everything right and there will be a bad outcome. Because bad outcomes that happen in obstetrical care, neurological damage and cerebral palsy, those are the two most likely to be litigated, are difficult to predict or to prevent. And so, but I don't think women understand that typically.
Well, go ahead quickly, doctor. Yeah.
No, I just wanted to add also the other major reason to be sued is for a shoulder injury during shoulder dystocia, which is when the baby's head is delivered and the rest of the body can't be delivered. So then that can produce an Erb's palsy, which is the child's not able to move its arm. And that's another thing that we can't. We try as hard as we can. Let's be really smart. Let's do an ultrasound and see if the baby's big, because if the baby's big, then we will do a C-section. Well, great. Makes sense. We have no data to prove that's help, and there's another reason to go ahead and do a C-section.
Well, I want to bring back in Michelle Mello from Harvard School of Public Health. So what are you working on to try to make this a little bit better for physicians, obviously, who fear what our doctor here on our panel had happened to him? What are some ways in which we can change the system to perhaps protect doctors from these huge settlements and make their lives a little bit easier and certainly make this process a little bit easier for everybody?
Well, I think there are two ideas that show particular promise, and neither of them are the traditional approaches to liability reform that the interest groups advocate for. The first is something called the communication and resolution model, in which hospitals have a very candid conversation with patients about unexpected outcomes of care, do a rapid investigation and feedback to patients, their findings about why the event occurred, and then seek a resolution with the family, which would include an early offer of compensation for a reasonable amount for the loss that they've suffered in cases where there was an error or negligence. But in cases where there wasn't error or negligence, the resolution is continued communication with the goal of seeking understanding about why the event occurred. This approach shows promise both in terms of reaching an expedited resolution of cases where the hospital does owe some money because there was a deviation from the standard of care. But, you know, statistically, the big value of this approach is in the majority of the cases where these bad outcomes are not attributable to substandard care. It is one of these unavoidable events. But we know that a major reason that families sue is to get information and reach that understanding about why this loss has occurred. And this process really has the ability to get that to patients without going through litigation. The second approach that I think is very promising is to just forget about negligence as a paradigm for figuring out who should bear the costs of taking care of these kids and develop an alternative way of looking after their needs over the life cycle, particularly if you accept the premise that statistically most of these cases are not due to negligence. We're left with the social question of how are we as a society going to help families who have suffered this devastating loss that can happen to any of us. And other countries have answered that with social insurance schemes. A couple of states here in the U.S. have set up their own birth injury funds for babies that have severe neurological injuries resulting from labor and delivery. They don't need to prove fault in order to get taken care of through that fund. They just have to prove that it was related to labor and delivery. And the obstetricians who participate in that scheme can't be sued for those injuries. Instead, they pay into this, again, a sort of social insurance system that looks after the babies over the life cycle of their need.
Dr. Dolger, quickly before we go to our break, do those two solutions strike you as things that make sense?
The first one is something we do all the time in the hospital. There's a bad outcome. We sit down with the patients right away and say, we don't know exactly what happened, but we're going to get back to you as soon as possible. We meet with them time and time again, and we've had great success with that. The second one is brilliant, and that would make everyone happy.
I want to thank Michelle Mello, who's a professor of law and public health at the Harvard School of Public Health, who joined us by phone today. Professor, thank you so much for joining us. I truly appreciate it.
Thank you.
Now, when we come back from our break, we've got a lot of people who want to join our conversation as we talk about cesarean sections in America today. 860-275-7266. We'll get to those calls right after this on Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Tomorrow, it's our weekly news roundtable, The Wheelhouse, and we're going to the Elm City. We're going to be in New Haven tomorrow talking with the New Haven Independent's Paul Bass and others about some of the news of the week, including tonight's mayoral debate in New Haven. You can join us, as always, on WNPR.org as well. Today, we're talking about the C-section epidemic in America. At least that's what our author calls it. Teresa Morris is the author of a new book called Cut It Out. She's a professor at Trinity College. Peter Dolger is here. He's an OBGYN specialist, and he's with the Connecticut Multi-Specialty Group. And we're taking your phone calls at 860-275-7266. Kate is in Middlebury. Hello, Kate.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well. What's on your mind?
Girls, five, almost six, and three. And the first one was born by cesarean, and the second was born by VBAC. What I wanted to mention today was one of the things I hadn't heard you talk about is that with the first birth, it was an emergency C-section. I had labored for a full day, and then based on the consistent fetal heart rate monitor, it showed that her heart rate was dipping. So they felt compelled to give me a cesarean. And then as a result, I developed an infection, and I was homebound for 5 weeks with intravenous medication. And so as a result, with my second pregnancy, I advocated very strongly for a VBAC for obvious reasons. Given that I had a two-year-old at home, I didn't want to be bound to my house again, given the risk of infection after the cesarean. So one of the things I just wanted to mention that I hadn't heard yet was the patient's, you know, the patient's role in advocating for their own, what they feel is right for their own needs and what their own pregnancy. And
Kate, because we're running low on time, you raise a great point that I really want to put to the doctor, and thank you so much for that. you heard what Kate said. It's something we want to get to.
I think the state of the field now is that part of our job is to empower women to make the decisions that are right for them. Gone are the days that we walk in and say, this is what needs to be done. So we need to give the information clearly, honestly, and then the patients need to give them to them in a way that they can help them to make the decisions that are best for them. But she was a great VBAC candidate. You know, she had a section for fetal distress, not because she couldn't push the baby out. She's the kind of patient that we want to encourage. Unfortunately, there are groups, many groups, that will not even offer VBACs to their patients.
Well, and we have tweets and emails coming in. Esmeralda asks, do you have any recommendations of where to go to have a supportive team to help a mother have a VBAC in Connecticut?
I would suggest that women look for hospital rates of C-section. That can be hard to get, but there's a website called cesareanrates.com where a consumer advocate, Jill Arnold, has collected hospital-level data for most states where women can go and look at the cesarean section rate at the hospital, and they vary greatly. So I think that that's one thing women should do. And the other thing is to ask providers their C-section rate and then to find a provider who will be supportive in a VBAC attempt.
But you have to be careful with that. I get transferred a lot of patients who are high risk from smaller hospitals that coming to Hartford Hospital to deliver for medical reasons. My section rate is going to be affected by that. If you work at a big hospital that gets transfers because babies have cardiac problems and you're going to do the section, their numbers are going to be higher. So high section rate doesn't necessarily mean you're going to a worse hospital.
That is true.
That makes a lot of sense. Brian in Middletown. Hi, Brian.
Hi. I'm a certified childbirth educator through the Bradley Method, which I'm hoping your guests have a somewhat positive view on. And I just want to kind of bring to bear the experience of teaching this for about 3.5 years. Basically, we see 4 or 5 couples every week. In fact, tonight's our weekly class. I'm sure they'll be talking about this show. And these are mothers and fathers coming together for 12 weeks at fairly great expense, precisely because they fear C-section or they fear an interventive birth. And I speak as someone who's also had 2 children born out of hospital. And what I think, piggybacking off your last guest and what your panelists just said, this transition from it being about the doctor's responsibility to make these emergent decisions to about patient empowerment really is the key, and it's what we see from these mothers and fathers, is that it's not about blaming obstetricians or blaming clinicians in other ways, midwives, et cetera. It's about this deep education and this understanding of what birth really is. If it's up to a doctor to make all the decisions from, and I hate to use this word, but an ignorant, panicked couple, mother and father, what choice do they really have? But if the father and mother are really able to weigh costs and benefits and look at the anthropological literature and look at the obstetrical literature and look at the experience of other mothers and fathers,
yes,
they have a lot better chance of having a birth outcome that is definitely the healthiest but also is truly empowering.
Well, and Brian, thank you very much for that. And I think just to pick up on this, one thing that I think that we haven't talked enough about is childbirth is one piece of life that you actually have some time to prepare for. There are classes. There are different groups that you can join. If you have something that comes upon you that is a medical crisis that is outside of childbirth and you have to make a decision and learn about it as a patient very, very quickly, it's much different. So Brian seems to be suggesting that people have some time and some methods to be able to at least get as much information as the doctor would.
I think that's a great point. One of the ways to decrease the number of cesareans is to do operative deliveries, forceps or vacuum delivery. Okay, but everything in life has a risk. You know, you can do a vacuum delivery and the baby can get a bleed in the brain and that can cause brain damage. Now, a patient's been pushing 2 or 3 hours and I think that's a good option. Is that the time to have that conversation? No. There's no way in the world you can have an adequate conversation. So those are the kind of conversations and information that has to start very early on in the pregnancy.
Mm.
In terms of information, I think that Brian has hit it head on, that we know that only about 1/4 of women now take childbirth education classes, and more women get information from the internet, which can be a good source of information, but the reliability varies. So one thing would be for women to take more childbirth classes, particularly independent classes like Brian and his wife give. Hospital-based classes tend to be more classes that are known to teach interventions, and the independent classes actually are more tied to scientific literature, most of the research suggests. And so I think that is important. And tying this back to what Kate's question about a repeat C-section versus a vaginal birth after cesarean section and the role of women's empowerment, There is a recent study that showed that most women chose repeat C-section or vaginal birth after cesarean section. They made that decision based on what they thought their provider wanted them to do, and most of them knew little. They did not know the risks well of either of those forms of birth. So I do think that there's a role that can be played in educating women, and that should start early.
I want to get to Jennifer in West Hartford. Hi, Jennifer. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi there. Thanks for having me on. I totally agree about the education and preparation needs to kind of boost up. But I think one of the keys is that as a society, we're generally dependent on drugs. And I know so many women who, before they've ever even had a child and they're pregnant, they decide, I don't want to feel this. Give me painkillers. I'm going to get an epidural. And they've never even experienced labor. And so I feel like, you know, that might be part of it, that they don't want to feel the pain. And so they decide, you know what, if I could get knocked out and have the kid, great. And I obviously there's emergency reasons, and I'm not one-upping, you know, anyone. But I feel like, you know, again, as a society, we're generally dependent on painkillers, numbing ourselves, and that might be part of the problem.
Jennifer, thank you very much for that. I want to quickly get a call from Shannon in Granby. Hello, Shannon.
Hi. Kind of on the along the lines of the last caller is, for my second child, our insurance changed just before she was born, like 3 weeks before she was born, and we had this very high deductible to cough up. So it was a little stressful where, you know, we knew we were having a baby in about 3 weeks-ish, and so we called the new insurance provider, and I was very surprised that they really pushed for a C-section, not even an induction, but like schedule a C-section. And even though, of course, we, you know, it would help us not to have to cough up this big deductible to have this baby, but it kind of astounded me where it was just really, really pushed upon, very commonplace, and it was hard. And
pushed upon you by your insurance carrier?
The insurance carrier was suggesting to schedule a C-section because we wouldn't have to cough up the big deductible that just changed. So when I went to the pediatrician, I was like, okay, it's three weeks prior, and my pediatrician, gynecologist said that you know, yes, you could do it, but I wouldn't advise it because, you know, I mean, anything could happen kind of thing. So I guess my whole point is that I was surprised that they were pushing it. I get it.
Well, I'm going to interrupt because we're very low on time. Teresa Morse, you seem surprised at what she's saying.
Yeah, I have to say, and we interviewed 83 women a day after they gave birth, and I haven't heard a story like this, an insurance provider pushing a C-section. Health insurance providers typically prefer women have a vaginal birth because it's a little bit less expensive for them. So I'm not sure about the role of an health insurance provider advocating that. I don't know if...
Well, I just have to say, and I apologize, we have about a minute left, and there's a lot of people who want to join this conversation. What I'm going to say, first of all, is if you want to continue online, WNPR.org on our page, you can continue this conversation, and we would like to hear from as many of you as possible. Doctor, what do you think out of this whole conversation that we've talked about? Should people really take away from this? What's something that we can do better to maybe change this? Because it seems as though we're all in agreement that something needs to change a little bit.
In 30 seconds, I can't tell you what we need to change. It's, you know, be as educated as you are and make the decision that you're most comfortable with and don't care if people agree or don't agree with you. You know, I think that's what you need to do. Find a provider that sits and talks to you and seems to really care about you and go from there.
Dr. Peter Dolger is an OBGYN with the Connecticut Multispecialty Group. Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
And Teresa, we just have a few seconds left with you. Your book is called Cut It Out, The C-Section Epidemic in America. I want to thank you very much for joining us. Is there any big takeaway, one-sentence takeaway from this conversation for you?
Right. Women should be more educated. Doctors should make their concerns known. And we should all have a discussion based on what Dr. Mello said about malpractice reforms to make it safer for women and babies.
Clearly, there is an awful lot more to talk about. I want to thank you both for coming in and doing this. Again, you can continue this conversation online at WNPR.org. Our program is produced by Tucker Ives with Betsy Kaplan and Heather Brandon. The senior producer of Where We Live is Katie Talarski. I'm John Dankosky, and this is Where We Live.